There were once two young men working their way through Leland Stanford University. Their funds got desperately low, and the idea came to one of them to engage the great Ignacy Jan Paderewski for a piano recital and devote the profits to their board and tuition. The great pianist manager asked for a guaranteed $2,000. The students, undaunted, proceeded to stage the concert. They worked hard, only to find that the concert had raised only $1,600. After the concert, the students met up with the great artist and told him of their efforts and results. They gave him the entire $1,600 and accompanied it with a promissory note for $400, explaining that they would earn the amount at the earliest possible moment and send the money to him. "No," replied Paderewski, "that won't do." Then, tearing the note to shreds, he returned the money and said to them, "Now take out of the $1,600 all of your expenses, and keep for each of you 10% of the balance for your work, and let me have the rest." The years rolled by, years of fortune and destiny. Paderewski became the premier of Poland. The devastating war that would become known as the First World War came, and Paderewski was struggling to feed the starving thousands of his beloved Poland. There was only one man in the world who could help Paderewski and his people. Thousands of tons of food and clothing and shoes began to come into Poland for distribution by the Polish premier. After the starving people were fed and clothed, Paderewski journeyed to Paris to thank Herbert Hoover for the relief sent to him. "That's all right, Mr. Paderewski," was Mr. Hoover's reply. "Besides, you don't remember it, but you helped me once when I was a student at college and I was in a hole." We will never fully know how God will use our kind and generous acts to help others. Only God knows what will happen. Let us trust in God as we now share our gifts through God's church mission and ministry.
It's true, we have no idea when we put an offering in the plate where that offering may go, how it may impact others. Herbert Hoover, as a student in college, didn't know that when Paderewski blessed him and his friend by giving them a break, that he would someday be in a position to help. Nor did Paderewski know that his offering of generosity would somehow come back to help him help his people in Poland. So when we put an offering in the offering plate, it has an opportunity to make a difference. And if you haven't put anything in there on your way in and you still want to do something, please do something on the way out. We'll start next week, I think, just so you're aware of it. We're going to move the offering plate to the front, and instead of you putting it in as you come in, we're going to have a time where we commit ourselves to that offering, so that when Jeremy shares a story like that, we'll then take a few moments to make a commitment to God in our own hearts as we come forward and put the plate. We'll have it like up here somewhere, and you can place your offering in at that time. So we'll make it a time of worship where we commit ourselves to God like that. I want to share a story from the scriptures with you this morning, but I want you to listen to it differently than maybe you have in the past. Usually when we listen to these stories, we focus in on Jesus and what Jesus is doing, and we look at the acts and how he moves through these communities and changes lives. What I would like you to do is focus more on the man that Jesus is dealing with. I want you to kind of get inside his head, get inside his heart, inside of who he is, and imagine what he's feeling, what he's experiencing in this tormented state that he is in. This is the story of Jesus encountering a man with supposedly a legion of demons within him. And I want you to try to sense what it might feel like for this man, be in his shoes. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs, when he came with an unclean spirit and met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain, for he had been restrained with shackles and chains. But the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke into pieces. And no one had the strength to subdue him. Again, get inside this man, what it feels like to be him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself and cutting himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and he bowed down before him and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him then, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there on the hillside was a great herd of swine that were feeding, and the unclean spirits begged him, "Send us into the swine, let us enter into them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the swine and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushing down to the steep bank into the sea, and they were drowned in the sea. The herders of the swine ran off and told it in the city and in the country. And then the people came out to see what had happened. They came to Jesus and saw the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And the very man who had had this legion, and they were afraid. Those who had seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. And so they began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. So as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might go with him. But Jesus refused and said, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you on this day and the mercy that he has shown to you." And so he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. Now, today I'm going to offer you a way to look at that that's a little less of spirits, demons, a little bit more connected to things we might see today. Because I want you to imagine, again, here we're talking about this man. Imagine what it's like to hear voices in your head that nobody else can hear. To see things that other people say they can't see. What it would be like to be tormented by these voices and these visions that no one sees but only you, and if for some reason you believe that somebody's in your head, that there are people inside of you or spirits inside of you that are tormenting you and telling you to do things you don't want to do. Today we call that someone with schizophrenia. I knew a guy who had schizophrenia, who practically was like this man that we hear here today. He was a member of my church at Neshaminy Church, he and his family. I didn't realize all that was going on with him. One day I came into my office and opened the door, and somebody had been in and slid under the door of my office a paper. When I picked it up, there was writing all over the paper and all just nothing that made sense, little drawings and just words and phrases that were, it sounded crazy to me. I had no idea where it came from. It talked about astronauts coming to Tohican Park. It talked about being raped as a young boy. It talked about all kinds of crazy things, stuff I didn't know where it was going, no rhyme or reason, just written up and down the page, sideways, upside down. I was turning it around and looking at it, trying to make sense, like, did some kid do this? What is this? Months later, I was doing a funeral in a graveside in Ben Salem when this guy from the church was there. And after I finished the service, he came up to me and I said, "So, Ken, what are you doing here?" I said, "Did you know this guy?" And he goes, "No, I just came so I thought somebody from the church should represent here at this service." And I thought, okay. And then he looked around and he said, "You know, I'm in this cemetery a lot of times around 2-3 in the morning. I go, you are? And he goes, yeah, I come here and I talk to these people and they tell me a lot of things. And I said, you know, Ken, you shouldn't tell people stuff like that because it makes you sound crazy. I didn't know it at the time. And then he said, did you ever get that note I left for you? And then it all started to come together. And then I had a talk with his mother and found out that he was suffering schizophrenia and that he was on medication, but sometimes he didn't take it. And he would hear voices in his head and he would see things and he would have conversations just like the man in our gospel lesson. I want to talk a little bit about armor. I'm going to sort of jump off of that, and we'll come back to it at the end. But in many ways, what he was doing is similar to what a lot of us do. He was doing it because his brain didn't work right. There was chemical reactions going on, firing off things that were just totally unrelated to one another, and that's why he had a difficult time in this world. And Ken doesn't live in this world anymore. He no longer could take it. He was younger than I was. Just about 10 years ago, he took himself out. But we find ourselves, even when our minds are firing pretty good, we still do things to protect ourselves because we are afraid to be vulnerable. We're afraid to have ourselves easy pickings for other people to pick and beat up on us. So we create armor for ourselves, and we put ourselves in armor that not so much that it's visible to the world, but we can feel its weight. We put it on to protect ourselves. And Brené Brown, who wrote about this power of vulnerability, talks about three different types of armor that we might put on. The first type of armor is called foreboding joy armor. And to give you an example of what that's like, it's like you've probably known people, maybe you're this kind of person, but the moment you're experiencing some joy, you have this sense of foreboding, like, oh, well, this ain't gonna last. Doom is on its way. Something bad is gonna happen, because as soon as you start to feel happy, you're afraid that something's gonna come and take your happiness away. And so you're always, just as you're feeling joy, it gets robbed from you. You protect yourself from it because you don't want to feel too much joy and then have to feel so much pain afterwards. So we protect ourselves from foreboding joy by putting armor on it. And so we start thinking that if I expect the worst to happen, at least I'm prepared. But this takes away the ability for us to enjoy life. You need to learn how to enjoy life. And what the word enjoy is really two words. Joy, which we understand is a happiness, an experience of being in a good place. And end, meaning to put something into, to enjoy, to enthuse. Like enthusiasm is en, in, enthuse has to do with God. To be enthusiastic is to have God excite you, experience God. And so when I say enjoy, we have to put joy into our life. And the only way we're going to do that, to be able to take this foreboding joy armor off, is we need to learn to live with gratitude. To take this moment, and no matter what's happening, be grateful for something in the moment, whether it's a negative experience or a positive, because a negative experience is a teaching moment. So even in negative times, even when we're experiencing downtimes, we can say, Lord, thank you for this downtime. I know I'll appreciate the good time when it comes. And it makes me appreciate all the good times I've had. And we can find some way to be thankful and live with gratitude so that we're not living constantly in a foreboding joy, having to protect ourselves by expecting negative. Let's be honest. We know life is up and down. We all know that. It's not going to always be up and it's not going to always be down. It goes through cycles. So let's just take it like a roller coaster and ride it out. I used to be afraid of roller coasters, actually. Hated them. Scared to death of them. And I was a counselor for the Jewish Community Center out of Ewing, New Jersey, as a bus driver, a bunch of us that worked for Van Trans and the Council Rock District. We got to drive the kids all over for one summer for their summer camps, and if we wanted to be counselors. So I chose to be a counselor and earn a little extra money. So there I am with all these 10th graders, and we went to Great Adventure. And they said, hey Tom, let's go on the roller coaster ride. And I was about 22, I guess. And these are 10th graders. And they're saying, you know, come on. And I'm like, well, I don't really like roller coasters. And they're giving me the, like, what? You gotta get on a roller coaster. And they were daring me. And how do you let 10th graders dare you to do something and not take care of it? So I finally said, okay. But I had a friend who came to me and said, Tom, I'll give you the secret to the roller coaster, how you can have fun on it. I said, what is it? He says, sit up in the front. And when you're going up the hill, man, you want to go hard up that hill. And when it starts going down, don't hold back, but like you're driving that thing, you want to go faster than the roller coaster's going. Push it. Try to make it go hard into the turns and the corkscrews. And he said, you just imagine you're taking that and you're in control. So I said, okay, I'll try. You know, what have I got to lose? I'm going to be on this thing anyway. So I did it. And I got to tell you, it was the most exciting ride. I was so excited I got back in line again. And that summer, we went to all these places all around the Northeast here, and I went on 13 roller coaster rides in one summer. I couldn't get enough of them. And it hit me later in life, like, that's what life is like. It's like a roller coaster ride. And sometimes when we're coming up against things we don't like, we're holding back, like, oh, I don't want to do this, I don't want to have to deal with it. And we have to just turn it around and say, you know what? I got to deal with it no matter what. Let me go at it and take control. I'm in control of the situation. So when you're going up or down, you are in control. You have some power, some authority to deal with. You have choices you can make in that ride. So to deal with the foreboding joy, take control. Live gratefully. Find ways to say, thank you, God, for this moment. The second armor is perfectionism armor. This is a defensive thing we put on, this armor of perfectionism, to protect ourselves from getting hurt again. What we're afraid of is we're going to be hurt by people who don't like us, who are going to say, you didn't do good, you're not good enough. And so what we try to do is we try to be perfect so that people can't complain. People can't say, you didn't do this right, you didn't do that right. And so we live with this perfectionism model, trying to do everything better than it can be done so that there's no room for anyone to pick on. Well, if you're living with that armor, the truth is, if you're like me, who once lived with that perfectionism in my mind, you know, I could always see what I did and say I could have done it a little better. If I'd had an hour longer, this would have been perfect. I always saw my faults, and I drove myself nuts trying to perfect everything, to make everything perfect. There are people who write sermons out. And I used to, I'd write everything out, and I'd go over every word. It's like, should I say to or of there? Because if I say to, then people will think this. I realized you weren't memorizing my sermons word for word. Although today, sometimes they get recorded, and I have to realize that's another situation. But I used to write it all out in manuscript, and I realized that I was spending an inordinate amount of time perfecting something that you didn't worry about. I used to do the three-point classic sermon, you know, the way the Greeks did writings to debate things, and I would go through all of that, having to come up with 3 points, and then I would try to do what I'm doing now, do my sermon without looking at it, and I realized I could never remember my third point. I'd always do 1 point, 2 point, then third point, what is it? And I'd have to look, and I expected you to remember my sermon, but I couldn't remember it. So I gave up on that. I've learned to relax my standards. I don't have to be perfect. In fact, a lot of times people will come to me and say, when you said this in your sermon, and I'll think, I never said that. I don't even think I ever thought that. But somehow you heard it. I've realized the Holy Spirit sometimes is speaking to you outside of what I'm saying and giving you a message that you need to hear. So I'm focusing on not having to be perfect, but just get it good enough that you get the point. So perfectionism armor. The antidote to that of trying to be perfect is learning to live with self-kindness. Putting so much pressure on yourself. treating yourself, like I talked about last week, as if you were treating your best friend, what they would say to you. That you're okay the way you are, that you're good enough at this point. And realizing that you're just like everybody else. You know, there's a common humanity among us, where each of us in our humanity suffers from these things. I've often stood up here and preaching and thought, man, those people are all much better Christians than I am. If they only knew what I'm really like, they would hate me. And then I realized, no, you're not that good after all. It took 20 years to learn that up at Green Pond, but you know, you start to realize, hey, these people have problems too. And I start to realize when I looked out, instead of looking out and seeing like all these super Christians and me feeling like the last person in the world that should be saying anything, I realized that they're all going through the same things I'm going through. They're all suffering, everyone. And I would look out and I'd see all the folks that I knew and the problems they faced and the life they lived, and I'd realize, boy, we're all struggling day to day to get by. We're all the same. That's the antidote for perfectionism. And the last piece of armor, the last kind of armor we might put on is numbing our armor. Numbing, N-U-M-B, to be numb. This is the armor that we do to avoid feeling things. So we put on the armor of alcohol, overdoing alcohol, or overusing drugs, or overeating, or undereating. You know, we do things to take control, to hide away from our feelings, because we don't want to see what we feel. We don't want to feel it. And so as soon as it starts to come to us and we start to feel something that we're afraid to feel, we start to feel vulnerable, we start to feel weak, we take a drink, or we take drugs, or we eat something, or we just get very busy in our job so we don't have to think anymore, and we work long hours, and we just stay away from ever thinking and feeling what's going on inside of us. Numbing armor tries to protect us. But see, all these armors actually do us more harm. That's the paradox of the whole thing. The armor that you put on to protect yourself destroys you. It makes you weak. Because vulnerability, we think, is weakness, and really it's strength. When you can be vulnerable and say, this is who I am, this is what's going on, we have strength. We take away the power of the vulnerability of being weak, and we can turn it into a strength. So back to so the antidote for that is prioritizing things in your life. Taking off your Superman cape, I learned this one recently, taking off that Superman or Superwoman cape and saying, you know what, I can't do everything. I can't do it all. I can't be perfect. I can't hide from my feelings. I can't be like such a, in a place where no one ever sees me cry. I have to be who I am. You know, the cape is not gonna protect us. So we need to take it off and say, I'm human. I feel. And when we take off the cape, we need to recognize, all right, since I can't do everything, what do I need to do? Now, some of you may have seen this illustration before. I'll just briefly, quickly tell you it. There was a professor who wanted to make a point with his students about priorities in life. So he had this big glass jar up on the front desk, and he put in all these big rocks until the rocks filled the whole jar and were up to the top. And he said to his students, all right, is the jar full? And the students all said, yes, that's full. Can't get another rock in there. And then he came out with a bag of marbles, and he started pouring the marbles in, and they filled all around the rocks until it got to the brim. And he said, okay, now is the jar full? And the students went, now it's full. Yeah, you filled, now it's totally full. Then he grabbed a bag of sand, and he started pouring sand in, and the sand went around the marbles and the rocks, and it filled it all the way to the brim. And he said, now is the jar full? And the student said, maybe? We're starting to not know. Every time we say yes, it seems like you have something else. So maybe it is, maybe it isn't. And then he brought out a pitcher of water, and he poured that in, and that filled up through the sand and the marbles and the rocks till it was at the top. And he explained to them, he said, this is how we need to learn to prioritize our lives. By putting the rocks in first, they represent the most important priorities of your life. Do them first. Put them into your schedule. Make sure you have time for them. And then you can go to things that are smaller and of less priority. But if you had started, he says, if I had started with the water and poured that in first, as all those little tiny priorities that don't mean as much, and I had started with that, there would have been no room for the bigger responsibilities I had, the bigger priorities. So make sure you look at your life and you say, what's the most important thing I have to do today? Make time for that. Make sure you give that your attention. And then move on. This is the way we're called to live. This is how we get rid of the numbing feeling. Because I know when I'm trying to numb myself with overwork and trying to avoid feelings, you know, if it's not food I'm stuffing down my face, I'm stuffing my time with all these little unimportant things, doing all these little tasks, saying, well, I got a lot of things done, but the most important thing got put to the side, and when it was time, now I'm spending an all-nighter trying to get it done because I put it off when I shouldn't have. Or I've lost it all together. Time with your family, time with a child, time with your spouse or a parent. You need to put those things in the schedule, in our time first. Not numb ourselves from it. Even if it's a challenging thing we have to do. And going back to our tormented man that Jesus meets, it heard that he was cutting himself with rocks. Some people do that to numb themselves. They don't use rocks, they use blades, something sharp, and they cut themselves. Cutting is self-harm, and it's meant to relieve ourselves for a moment of the pain of the emotions we might have. We're trying to hide. It's a numbing armor that people do, and yet they're harming themselves. And guess what? Not everybody cuts themselves. I've discovered as I've listened to this topic discussed, I've realized that there are people like me who just bite their nails all the time to numb themselves. It's the same form of self-harm. I don't know if anybody else here bites your nails, but you know, I went almost a year without biting them. I was obsessing over them, cleaning them. I had beautiful nails for the first time in my life because I've been biting them since I can remember. And then we moved into the new building up there at Green Pond, and there was a lot of excitement, but also a lot of pressure. And I was hearing all this stuff, and I just, like, one day I thought, okay, one nail. And I just ripped the one nail, and oh, it felt beautiful. I can't tell you how great it felt. I was like, oh, one more nail. By the end of that 5 minutes, all my nails that I'd spent a year growing and taking care of were gone. And I haven't grown them back. It's a form of self-harm. It's a form of numbness to avoid my feelings. And I know that now. And I'm working on that. When I catch myself biting my nails, because yeah, I'm often not even aware of it, I start thinking, what am I avoiding? What's going on that I'm trying to stay away from? What armor am I putting on myself to hide from the truth? Jesus comes to this man who's harming himself. If he's got schizophrenia, he doesn't know how to heal it, and no one else does because they just believe it's demons. But look how Jesus deals with him. Let's pretend for a moment that the man is suffering from schizophrenia. And let's believe Jesus knows that this is some mental illness. But he knows that there's no way he can explain that to this man or to these people. He believes he's infested with demons. And he needs someone to help him. And Jesus looks at him and he says, I can heal him, but I'm going to have to show him how he is to be healed. And so he said, the demons start saying, don't send us out of the country, send us into those pigs. Now, Jesus is Jewish, and the pigs are not a thing that the Jewish people will touch. But if Jesus is also God, he loves those pigs. But he loves this man even more. And so he says, if that will help this man, I will let him believe that this is what's going on. And so he lets this man scream as if all the demons are coming out, and the screaming affects the pigs and scares them, and they run and just following the leader right into the sea. And the man feels healed. And Jesus has perhaps healed his schizophrenia with God's supernatural power, but he did it in a way that the man would understand he is free. And that was what getting our armor off is meant to do, to free us, to take away the shackles and the chains that we bind ourselves in and the armor that we put on that we think protects us, but is killing us, and says, be vulnerable. In vulnerability, you're free. In vulnerability, you're healed. In vulnerability, you're strong. God wants to take off that clunky armor that you've been putting on all these years and say, be vulnerable. If you have a friend that you can talk to, or if you need to talk to me about this at some point, you know, a covenant between the two of you, your friend and you, that you can talk about whatever it is, that they will not judge you or try to fix you, but they will just listen and love you and help you to figure out your way through it. If you can find that friend to do that, God wants to heal you, to take away your armor, throw it in the trash heap, because you don't need it anymore. He has armor that's better. It's the armor of truth, the armor of righteousness and peace that Paul has labeled. These are the armor, this is the armor we need. And it protects us better than any of these false armors. So God says, be free. Be vulnerable. And you'll be strong. Amen.